Chapter 22. Helotyne, Canticus Southern District. The Cairns. So named for the immense stone pillars beneath which were the burial mounds of saints, ecclesiarchs, and palatines, the Cairns had ever been a place of solemnity in Canticus. That sense of reverence had been shattered with the arrival of war, and the Cairns was no longer a place of peace anymore. It was a vast area, deep into the southern district, and far beyond the fragile territory the Imperials had established with their previous victory. Surrounded by his honour guard, the Serpentia, and standing amidst these ruins, Drakkard regarded a hollow map of the region.
"What do you see, Elysius?" he asked his chaplain.
The grey image rotated slowly, hazing in and out of focus as it completed each revolution. It showed contours, structures, even a degree of geological depth. The various reliquaries, tombs, and votive shrines Canonus Angera had described were visible as darker areas on the map, representing fissures and subterranean undercrofts. Some were very deep, and the trail of relic sites went for long periods without interruption.
"I see a world beneath a world, Brother Captain," said the chaplain, "hidden from our sight."
Word had come back from several of the other battle groups operating within Canticus. The assault on Salvation Bridge had been successful, thanks in no small part to some of Angera's seraphim. In the Templum district and adjacent slums, Korad had conducted a successful bombing campaign to link up with Sergeant Xantho's armored column. Enemy resistance was staunch, but ultimately overcome. Combined, it was the single largest territorial gain the Salamanders had made since arriving on Helotyne.
"Here, though?" asked Drakkard. "The war rests on this city alone. Victory in Canticus means victory on all of Helotyne. I need to understand why that is."
"Perhaps the Canoness is right," offered Elysius. "Some ritual significance has drawn the warlord of the Black Legion to the city. By thwarting these plans and killing him, we break his warband and free Helotyne of this tyranny."
"It matters not, Brother Captain. All that matters is we prosecute this duty to its bitter conclusion and make the lives lost in payment of it worth something."
By turning his wrist, Drakkard altered the bare topographical view and brought up a tactical overlay displaying the current disposition of his forces throughout the Cairns. Such a large region demanded a wide dispersal, and Drakkard had split what remained of his troops and the Cadian survivors into two distinct battle groups. 18 pillars, or cairns, soared into the smoke-choked air above Canticus. Occasionally, when a strong wind briefly swept away this red-grey miasma, the summits were visible without need of spectral magnification. 7 of the 18 still had the statues of the pious individuals whose bones were allegedly buried beneath them, along with a swathe of lesser faithful, too numerous and unimportant to mention, beyond an engraving on a votive plaque at the base of the pillar. According to its now scattered population, the pillars were believed to uphold the roof of heaven, and should they ever fall, the very firmament above Helotyne would collapse. Drakkard wondered if there was any truth to that. Were the heretics attempting to sunder the pillars? Was there a weakening of the veil between reality and the warp in this place? And would this act of destruction bring about a rift between them? Drakkard was no psyker. His knowledge of such metaphysics, while far superior to the average citizen of the Imperium, was crude compared to the likes of a chapter librarian. He knew the pillars were immense in size, and despite the war, all had endured so far. Perhaps the heretics sought to use other non-corporeal means to collapse them. Certainly he had heard of great temples that had stood for millennia, crumbling inexplicably when their spiritual link to the emperor was severed. It would explain the targeted destruction of the relic sites, as well as the Adepta Sororitas's presence on Helotyne. All of the 18 adhered to a pattern, forming an octachidecagon with 9 pillars each on either side of the Sanctium Vius, or Holy Road, a long and expansive processional avenue that ran all the way from the Cairns to the Veloth Desert in the east. Drakgard's 2 battle groups, led by himself and veteran Sergeant Kadoran, were arrayed either side of this processional deep into the labyrinthine avenues and sprawling habitation towers that riddled the area. It was tight, fraught with dead ends, choke points, and blind zones. In short, it was dangerous territory and likely occupied in some force. Unfortunately, that enemy was also currently in hiding. Fortunately, Drakgard had the means to seek them out from whatever rock they had crawled under.
Targons, he addressed a squad of 5 Fireborn clad in hulking Centurion armor.
The Targons were borrowed from 4th Company, nominally the heavier class of Assault Marine, compared to the lighter and faster Wyverns. Each armature or rig was equipped with siege drills on both arms and underslung heavy flamers. Unlike his men, Sergeant Bardak's rig was equipped with melters instead. All 5 Targons were armed with hurricane bolters fitted to the torso. Essentially individual war suits, the Centurions were effectively worn by the Assault Marines, who simply stepped into the up-armored rig in full battle plate. At the sound of Captain Drakgard's voice, Brother Sergeant Bardak turned. He was slow to do so, the war suit pilot sacrificing speed and maneuverability for superior offensive and defensive capabilities.
"You are the vanguard, Brother Sergeant," said Drakgard, clenching his fist to shut off the hololith. "Take us in."
Bardak led the line of warsuits out. Within minutes, their armored forms were lost amidst smoke and dust. Only the sound of their heavy footfalls as they stomped through the rubble gave away the fact of their existence. Drakgard had his Serpentia Honor Guard and a tactical squad moving up in support. He switched his retinal lens display to tactical view and saw a truncated schematic of the terrain and his units advancing through it, rendered as icons over his left eye. He opened up the Voxlink.
"Captain Helfer, you are to stay behind us with the Devastators until we breach this area proper."
"Understood, my lord," came the swift reply.
Helfer was the leader of 4 squads of elite Kasrakins. They wore heavier armor than Colonel Redgage's regular troopers and carried rebreather masks along with an array of specialist assault weaponry and hellguns, an enhanced version of the lasgun. Hellguns enjoyed improved armor penetration capability over their standard-issue counterpart. But even with this augmentation, they were no match for power armor. Ordinarily cast as stormtroopers, the Kasrakins were reduced to a support role until the Targons could establish the level of enemy resistance and root it out. Drakgard had assured Redgage he would not use his men as bait or treat their lives cheaply. Against traitor space marines, the Kasrakin were at a disadvantage. Drakgard wanted to mitigate that first, before deploying into Canticus warzone. An icon associated with the 2nd battle group flashed up on Drakgard's right lens display, rendered in luminous crimson over a transparent background, tinged the same, only lighter. Veteran Sergeant Kadoran had just given notification of simultaneous deployment of his own troops. As of yet, there was no word from Canoness Angora. Drakkard was about to try to raise her on the vox when a final marker blinked up on his display below the first.
"Sisters are moving in behind us," he voxed to Eliseus alone. "Angora left it late for confirmation."
The chaplain had joined the Serpentia as part of Drakkard's command squad.
"She is still unhappy that you insisted on us going in first."
"It is our right," Drakkard replied. "I won't have the glory of this victory stolen from under us by the Ecclesiarchy."
"Glory? Is that why we are here, brother captain?"
"Now is not the time to try and peer into my immortal soul, chaplain."
"Just so long as you are clear why we are fighting this war."
"It is our duty, Eliseus."
"That is our purpose, to do our duty, not the reason why we came to Helotine."
The pain of his injuries was making him irascible, so Drakkard cut the conversation short before he said something to the chaplain he would later regret. There was one thing he wished he had voiced aloud, though. A question. "Can we trust them, brother?" Angora fed the string of rosary pearls between her gauntleted fingers. She paused when she reached the black opal. All those souls she had saved, and just this one, eluded her. Sensing she was being watched, Angora glanced up. Lavinius was staring at her.
"How can you know where?"
asked the scarred warrior. Her Celestians were nearby, waiting patiently for their sister superior and canoness outside of the ship. It was one of several corralled together and brimming with adepta sororitas. They had touched down at a landing strip at the edge of Canticus, ostensibly to redeploy once the salamanders and Cadians had made sufficient ingress into the city and engaged the enemy.
"With faith," Angora replied, letting go of the rosary. "And with this."
She produced a small brass artifact. When flat, it resembled a teardrop, but unfolded across its fragile hinges, it was more like a compass. In fact, that is exactly what it was. Setting the brass compass down, Angora then took a phial of clear liquid from her trappings.
"Precious little sorrow left," she murmured.
Lavinius remained still and stared at the glass bottle as Angora decanted the last few drops onto the arrow of the compass. Then she waited. The seconds seemed to lengthen, both warriors waiting in silence for the compass to move. It trembled at first, then the arrow spun around to settle in one direction. Angora removed one of her gauntlets and held her bare hand over the compass so she could feel its emanations against her skin.
"Not far," she said.
When she put her gauntlet back on, Lavinius saw a reddening of Angora's skin from where the compass had lightly blistered it. Gently, Angora picked up the compass and handed it to Lavinius.
"Give this to only your most trusted warrior. Then get everyone on board. We are leaving immediately."
"And the others, my canoness?" asked Lavinius, taking the compass reverently and being careful not to spill a drop of the liquid. Angora was already moving to the front of the transport where she would take up position in the cockpit alongside the pilot and gunner. She only half turned.
"Have them hold position for now. I want to be absolutely sure before we commit to this. I want to see her with my own eyes, sister."
There were catacombs beneath Canticus, and they stretched beyond the bounds of the city. Some reached as far as Escadan, others went all the way to Solist. They were old and largely forgotten. It was where the Helotines had once buried their relics and their dead. It was a place of saints that had now become a lair for sinners. No one ventured into the catacombs anymore. They were dark and uncharted places, none save for those with longer memories and the reason to do so, none save for the unholy and the blasphemous. The anteroom was carved from the very bedrock of the world and festooned with skulls like the rest of the underground ossuary. Sigils had been cut into the walls, signifying the proto-imperial creed that had since spread to become the dominant form of religion in the galaxy. Smashed, befouled, these sigils had no power here now. Pillars raised the ceiling. In places, it was high enough to house a titan, stretching up into the gloomy vaults, speared with stalactites. There were deeps, great wells that fell into black oblivion. A core of Helotine's raw elements had existed here once, a fossil fuel used to synthesize promethium production. Miners and riggers had denuded this wealth, sacked it for their profit and prosperity. Men now long dead, their skeletons had joined the masses already entombed, but with unmarked graves and forgotten lives. In their wake came the Ecclesiarchy, the great Adeptus Ministorum. In vast ships they crossed the ocean of stars and braved the Empyrean itself to bring a lost world back into the fold. Some said it was the Crusade reborn, but they were foolish men, given over to vainglory. It was but one world, yet no less significant for that fact. The Ecclesiarchy reclaimed this land from the industrial tyrants who had yoked from it Helotine's blood and marrow. Tombs thought lost for millennia were rediscovered. New relics were interred in the earth. Shrines were raised, reliquaries formed. For the cardinals and the palatines knew this world's legacy as well as its spiritual significance and sought to gird it. But holy men are not the only beings privy to secrets, those locked away in ancient librariums or contained in the rasped whispers of the damned. Demons know things too. Two warriors knelt before an immense statue. It was dark in the chamber, the only light cast by flickering torches, and in the shadows the statue loomed over them, powerful and oppressive. So still that despite its anger, anyone entering the chamber without prior knowledge could otherwise be forgiven for not realizing it had anima and was flesh, not stone. Kneeling was not easy for these warriors, and not just because the hulking armor plate they were wearing had not been fashioned with the need for penitence in mind. Pride had compelled them to remain standing, but against the will of the towering statue figure, they fell awkwardly in supplication. "We have lost the bridge, my lord," rasped one. His armor was festooned with skulls, several impaled on spikes, with others hanging from loops of dark chain and wire. A war helm was clasped under his arm, a blood-red topknot rising from the crown in a plume. His face was patchwork, a raft of knitted-together skin, each taken from a different provider. None of the flesh-givers had been willing participants in Kargol's art, however. The statue spoke, though in the darkness it was hard to tell if his lips actually moved. His voice was unmistakable, and though akin to human, was most definitely unkind to any mortal being.
"There were six of you that went out. Where are your brothers?"
There was genuine concern in the question, and it was obvious then that the statue figure's anger was directed at his enemies for the slaying of his men and not for the apparent failure of those selfsame warriors. Now the other spoke up. A long-barreled reaper cannon rested on his knee. He too was helmed, but left it on. It was part of him, fused to his flesh, and could not be removed. Jade embers blazed behind his eye slits, as if beneath the irremovable helm his face was perpetually on fire. For all his brothers now knew, perhaps it was. Ever since the changing, Kaid had been this way. Unlike some, he embraced the gifts and willed his gods to bestow further boons. He wanted glory, so he had gladly bent the knee and joined the rest of the Children of Torment when the Warmaster had made his offer. Here in this dusty catacomb of piled skulls and other forgotten bones, he did so again, but not in the same cause. Conquest, a chance to fight at the head of a black crusade, that was Kaid's desire. Glory. Down in the dirt with the long dead, he felt far indeed from such a promise. For how could his god see him here in this pit, searching and scrabbling in the dirt?
Arvan and Helox are dead. Sokred we lost to the river. Only the Eye knows where he now resides.
There was bitterness in Kaid's voice that he failed to hide. Despite the helm, his ambition was etched plainly on his brute metal face.
Should I ask it?
Said the statue figure, affecting an air of menace with the coldness of his tone to the two veterans knelt before him.
Or would you like to, Kaid? Your desire for advancement is as palpable to me as the blade sheathed at my hip.
He did not move to the weapon, which was immense and forged of warp-bonded black iron. He did not need to enhance the threat he had just made.
But know this, brother, the statue added. There are many ways to ascend, some more inglorious than others. You are in service to the War Master's Black Legion. On Helatine, I am War Master. If I choose to have you scrabbling in the dirt, then that is what you will do.
Kaid suppressed a shiver. It was as if the words had been plucked from his mind.
Oh, the alternative is I bury you under it. For a brother...
He paused, and there was emotion straining his voice.
A true brother never questions the orders of his captain. How I long for such days again.
Kaid bowed his head as the towering figure seemed to lose himself in remembrance. He knew he had gone too far and was quick to show contrition.
That will not be necessary, my lord. I can track Sokred, either bring him back or his body. Sokred will find his own way back to us, if he lives, said the figure, dismissing Kaid's offer with the slightest shake of his head. I suspect he will attempt to amuse himself along the way.
As he moved, the weak underground light inside the cavern caught the edge of his face. It glistened and did not resemble skin at all, though that is what it was supposed to represent. It was more like porcelain or glass, the kind of material used to create a doll or the facsimile of a man.
And our enemies? He asked. They move?
Kargol silenced his brother by speaking first.
They move, my lord, in armored column, with outriders wearing jump packs. Then we have nothing to concern us. Arvan and Helox will be remembered. Sokred, too, if he is also dead. Rise, said the lord, turning to face the figure in the background who was regarding them. Return to your brothers. Our other enemies will be here soon. We must be ready for them.
Kargol and Kaid got to their feet with the snarl of servos and took their leave. Down the long tunnel behind them and in the larger cavern beyond, the sound of the muster could be heard. warriors were preparing for battle. With over half their number dead or missing, the two brothers would divide the war bands evenly.
"You see, Kaid," uttered the lord to the warriors back as he was walking away, "your fortunes in the eye of the gods improve already."
Kaid paused.
"Yes, my lord Faustus,"
before moving on. Faustus paid him no further heed and approached the watcher, stepping into the light as he did so. Apart from his head, which was bare and oddly the most artificial part of him, Faustus wore full warplate. Coal black, it wrapped his muscular form like a second skin, the epitome of his legion. It was also of a size and magnitude greater than the warrior in front of him. Faustus half again larger in every aspect. The other warrior bowed, but without the trepidation of the two terminators.
"Why do you insist on them calling you that?" he asked.
Faustus was nonplussed.
"It is my name, Heclion Faustus."
"It was your name."
"And what is your name, brother?"
Faustus asked, though he knew it full well and was crafting a lesson for his favourite underling. The other had received this particular teaching before.
"Lufurian, as it has ever been. But you are not he, not entirely."
Viperously fast, Faustus seized Lufurian by the edge of his gorget and dragged him forwards. The light from a brazier's flame flickered over them both, casting deepening shadow. It made the ridges of their armor shine and burn with reflected fire. More importantly, it exposed Lufurian's surgeries. Beneath his armor, every major limb and joint bore the marks of amputation, followed by attachment. Only the neck and arms, which were bare of armor plate, bore them obviously. Lufurian's face was not his own. That had been a fire-ravaged ruin. He had taken his new visage from an old friend, one who had betrayed him, and who he betrayed in turn. He smiled, revealing an overwide jaw. Pointed teeth ran all the way across his face, up to his ears, and there was an acid burn etched into an inverted V shape on his chin.
"True," Lufurian replied, seemingly unconcerned.
One of his lackeys devised to draw a weapon, but a savage glance from Lufurian stayed the foolish warrior's hand. Fortunately, Faustus was too lost in his own theatre to see it.
"I have made myself flawless again, but you," Lufurian said, smiling thinly and nodding at the monster holding him in its grasp, "are not Faustus."
"I am a true Chthonian,"
Faustus sneered proudly.
"That you are."
Faustus wasn't ready to let him go just yet. He glared, pain and hate warring for dominance in his eyes. They were strange, eldritch things, simultaneously ageless and yet also weary.
"You and I are not familiar enough. You are not Clyed or Ahenobarbus or Nathius. They were true brothers."
Faustus drifted into the past again, and Lufurian took advantage of the warrior's momentary lapse in purpose.
"I came to tell you we are ready."
Faustus blinked as if revived from a dream. He let him go.
"Show me."
The genuine longing in Faustus's voice was in stark contrast to the practiced indifference of Lufurian's.
"Of course. This way, my lord. I'll be with you momentarily."
Faustus deigned not to answer. Lufurian met Cleric's gaze. He was Incarnadine, one of Lufurian's sworn warriors, now allied to the Children of Torment. Like the rest of the war band and its warlord, the Incarnadine host wore armor of heliotrope purple. Fashioned over the plate metal were leathern strips of cured flesh, baked and hardened. To this grisly apparel was added studs, spikes of bone and bloody daubing. Blades were favoured. Every man was scarred, imperfect in some way, to better emphasise their warlord's own flawlessness. Lufurion knew it was vain, but he did not care. All except for Cleric. As Lufurion's bloody right hand, Cleric was permitted to be flawless, too. Aside from a short cape of flesh, his armour went without the fetishistic trappings of his brothers.
"Marshal the men, Cleric. It will not be long now. They'll be coming for her."
Cleric nodded, eyeing Faustus as he left the room, then asked,
"Who is dealing with our other pressing concern?"
"Voshkar."
Cleric gave a quiet, ironic laugh.
"That maniac. Hopefully he'll end up dead."
"Hopefully."
Lufurion's tone suggested he didn't think that was going to happen.
"I heard our errant brothers met with ill fortune, Captain,"
Cleric whispered, though Faustus was already gone and had paid the warrior's furtiveness no heed. Lufurion clapped him on the shoulder.
"This makes our endeavours here even more important."
Cleric nodded again and went to his duty as Lufurion went after Faustus into another subterranean cavern. It was deeper than the previous one, and they had to descend a long ramp of earth to reach it. In ages past, some effort had been made to pave the area with stone, but much of it had been worn away by entropy. Stepping through a wide arch, high enough for Faustus to pass under without stooping, was a vaulted chamber that ran on for several meters. A silver casket lay on a plinth at the end of it. Three of Lufurion's warriors surrounded the casket, the igniters on their flamers burning a dormant blue.
"Within the sacred bones of Lucrezia Apsitia," said Lufurion, his words barbed enough to pierce flesh. "She is one of their saints, another false idol. Just a mouldering corpse, one this false empire likes to revere,"
Lufurion replied, nodding to his men. Tongues of fire spewed from the mouths of their weapons, lapping at the casket eagerly. For a moment, the venerable tomb of Saint Apsitia seemed impervious, but after a few seconds, it ran with flowing silver tears. Quickly turning molten, the casket bled all over the plinth, and then the floor, oozing like wax. Like many of his kind, Lufurion was a child of the warp. Though not a true Neverborn, he could nonetheless feel the veil between reality and the ether thin with the destruction of the casket. He shuddered, chilled, and excited at the same time. A ripple passed through Faustus, too. Lufurion saw it reflected in the mirror sheen of the silver before it curdled and blackened. In it, Faustus was revealed as a monster, a demon spawn trapped in the shell of a man. The lunar wolf was screaming, a proud warrior of Chthonia no longer. Lufurion did not witness what Faustus saw. A warrior of the old war, the first great war, clad in legionary battle plate. He saw the ideal, the lie. Slipping from the present for a moment, his gaze seemed to wander as he outstretched his gauntleted hand.
"They are close," he whispered. "I can hear their voices calling out to me. Ahenobarbus, Nathius, Clyde, all of them."
Faustus lowered his hand, withdrew from the warp and the past life it held in thrall. He turned his attention to Lufurion.
"Bring forth the witch."
At Faustus's command, a tall and robed figure emerged from the shadows into the dying light of the fire. His violet armor marked him out as one of the Incarnadine. Lufurian gave Priest a subtle nod as their eyes met across the lake of molten silver that had spilled from the casket like blood. Faustus stepped through it, largely heedless of the sorcerer and intent on whom he clasped in his gauntleted hands. She was little more than a girl, weak and blind, a gossamer-thin chasuble clinging to her frail frame like a pair of flaccid, diaphanous wings. She was, in many respects, an insect, but a useful one, at least for the present. She was flanked by another pair of mortals, a male and female, their features hidden behind their robes, but all too visible to the demonic sight of Faustus. He noted the chains that were locked to the iron collars around their necks and was careful to keep his distance. Priest bowed in supplication.
"Master," he hissed.
Faustus ignored him, stooping to seize the girl by her bony jaw. She was weeping, for her plight or the desecration of St. Absetia's tomb, it did not matter. All that concerned Faustus were her tears.
"Cry, little witch. Tell me where my brothers are to be found."